Rough Trade is giving away a third of the first 3 months of the Rough Trade Club plus new music membership exclusively to 101 Part-Time Jobs listeners. Become a member of Rough Trade Club New Music and you'll receive the Rough Trade Album of the Month straight to your door every month on an exclusive vinyl pressing with bonus material. Club members have received exclusive pressings of albums from Sufjan Stevens, Sprints, The Last Dinner Party, English Teacher, and Over Mono, just to name a few, this past year alone. Sign up using the promo code CLUB101POD and you'll get Rough Trade's Album of the Month, Camera Obscura's Look to the East, Look to the West, for a third of the usual price. By signing up, you'll be getting Rough Trade's exclusive issue of the album on opaque purple in a gatefold sleeve, plus a bonus CD containing 5 demos. Don't want the album of the month but still want all the benefits? Sign up to the standard tier using CLUB101POD and you'll still get the first month free. You'll also get free shipping on all orders, 10% off at the bar and on secondhand vinyl in store, and exclusive access to sold out Rough Trade events. So don't hang around. Head to roughtrade.com/club and sign up with the code CLUB101POD. That's CLUB101POD and claim money off Rough Trade's Album of the Month today. This offer is for UK residents only. Do you play in bands? I did for the longest time, and I wish that I knew that DistroKid was a thing. I don't even think it existed back then. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads, and artists keep 100% of your royalties and earnings. 1 million+ artists rely on DistroKid to get their music on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all the major streaming services. When you get DistroKid, you can see a DistroKid bank and withdraw your earnings. You get notified when you've earned royalties and you can withdraw via the app. And you can even check your streaming stats on Spotify and Apple. Get 30% off your first year on DistroKid by going to distrokid.com/VIP/101pod. 30% off for your first year. That's not bad. We know it's a tough world out there. Why don't you make it easier for yourself? And to get 30% off that free year as an artist, where you get 100% of your royalties and earnings, go to distrokid.com/VIP/101pod. All right, stay with me. I'll be right back after this.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
101 part-time jobs, 101 part-time jobs, 101 part-time jobs, 101 part-time jobs. All right, you're listening to 101 Part-Time Jobs. It's the podcast where I speak to some very talented folk about different stages they've been at with their music over their time doing it, as well as some of the stories from their old careers. On today's episode, we're very happy to welcome Steve Mason, who this Friday releases his 5th solo record, Brothers and Sisters. He's going on tour with the band this spring. That's hitting Birkenhead, Sheffield, Oxford, Leeds, Sunderland, Glasgow, Manchester, London, Nottingham and Brighton from towards the end of April into May. The record sounds brilliant, and I think with a full band, those live shows are going to be excellent. Cheers for listening to 101 Part-Time Jobs, supported by 2000 Trees Festival, which is a great independent rock festival in Cheltenham, just a few hours away from London. They've been making new band announcements for the last week, and today they've announced some more, including American Football, Employed to Serve, Prima Queen, Military Gun, Bat Sabbath, and loads more. That's on top of Frank Hart and the Rattlesnakes, 100 Reasons, Rival Schools, The Bronx, loads of brilliant bands heading to 2000 Trees this July. If you want to go but haven't got your ticket yet, you can go to 2000treesfestival.co.uk, and if you use the voucher code 101pod when you're buying a ticket outright, you can get £20 off the price, which is basically free money if you know you're going anyway. The instalment plan ends at the end of tonight, if that sounds more sensible. Yeah, 2000 Trees Festival. It's brilliant. Thanks again for listening. Here's Steve Mason on 101 Part-Time Jobs. Go well. Cheers.
As an artist, you have to sort of accept that you're not in it for the money, you know, and so you have to just live with the fact that you are probably always going to be skint, and you're not going to be able to afford to do things that other people can do, people who have job, you know, even just normal jobs, or especially not well-paid jobs. You have to accept that you're not going to be able to do that. You're not going to be able to go on holidays. You're not going to be able to have, a nice new car. You'd be very lucky if you can afford to buy a house or get a deposit together for a house. And you have to live very much hand to mouth, and you have to kind of, I guess, have the courage to be able to do that, and which is very easy when you're younger. But it becomes less easy when you get older for many different reasons. But the most obvious reasons in my case being that I'm now married and I have a 5-year-old daughter. So when you have people relying on your income, there's a lot more pressure, and it feels like quite an intimidating situation to be in, within which still to attempt to be creative.
Yeah.
I mean, I've always, I guess, been most creative when I'm kind of, I don't necessarily need to be happy, but there needs to be a certain element of stability. So yeah, I mean, it's just kind of that side of it is one part of it. But then I guess the other part of it is just that drive, the thing that drives you on, which is loving the creation of brand new art and trying to consistently surprise yourself and push forward and better what you've already achieved and add to the sort of greater canon of work of artists globally, and hope when the books are opened up, your name will be in the books as someone to take note of.
It's brilliant speaking to someone like you with such a canon, such like a deep pocket of tunes and records and real experiences and the impacts that you've had on people's lives. You know, the soundtracks and the feelings that you've given people. I mean, I wonder how much you've been able to kind of ruminate on that and kind of identify that fire inside of you that you have to do this thing and try and protect it. You know, have there been times throughout your life that you've had to be forced to protect it and prioritize that?
Really, what you're talking about only really happened to me in the sort of time preceding the writing of Brothers and Sisters. So the album, the previous album to this one was called About the Light, and I got Stephen Street to produce that because I'd just become a dad, I'd just got married, and I really wanted somebody who was really competent, knew what they were doing. I sort of wanted to be a bit less hands-on, and I suppose someone that was gonna help me potentially create something that might get played on the radio. But then going into this one, I realized that potentially going down that road of chasing radio plays and kind of becoming a potentially a reactionary, maybe, it wasn't me, and it was a mistake. And that's not, you know, I'm not in any way having a dig at what Stephen Street did whatsoever. I wanted them to come in, and he did exactly what I wanted. But I just felt personally as an artist that if you deviate from the path of truth with respect to your art, then you're never going to really achieve anything except the destruction of your own art. So really, I had to sort of have a word with myself and really work out what it was I wanted to do, whether I wanted to stop and try and do something else, get a job, I don't know, something else. For the first time ever since I've dared to call myself an artist, I was being tested. You know, did I really want to do it? Did I really want to do it to the point where I was prepared to, you know, carry on living in a way which is hand to mouth, carry on living in a way which is somewhat precarious for the love of music and for the love of what I might be able to achieve and might be able to do? Or was I just going to pack in at that point? And I mean, not necessarily take an easier route, because trying to get a job, you know, is very, very difficult anyway. So I had to sort of really decide what it was I wanted to do. And then once I decided that I didn't want to give up, I didn't want to stop, then I had to, again, realize that I had to remember what it's like to be an artist. And I have to and decompartmentalize the family situation and just start, because what I used to do, you know, before I had any responsibilities, I spend a hell of a lot of the week sitting around daydreaming or watching films or just thinking or doing nothing. And then there'd be kind of bursts in the sort of, you know, from sort of 10 p.m. till 4 a.m., you know, and I'd stay up doing that. But you can't live like that when you live in a house with a family. You can't live like that. So you have to sort of, and I'd never really compromised my living in any way. I'd never had to, because I'd always kind of pretty much lived on my own pretty much. So yeah, you have to learn to compromise. I mean, yeah, you have to learn to compromise, and you have to learn that compromising in certain areas doesn't dilute your art. And then you have to realize that the areas where your art is not being diluted are the things that you need to kind of amplify and shine a light on and embrace those things with as much vigor as is possible.
That's a great answer. Thank you so much for getting into this, you know, because I realize that this conversation by nature, you know, it kind of requires you to dig deep, really. After About the Light, and you know, whether, you know, when you decided that you did want to do the next record, when you decided you did want to do what was going to become and what is Brothers and Sisters, were there, you know, you talked about, okay, well, what do I want to do? Were there any kind of prerequisites or any kind of specific points you wanted to do in yourself? You know, you talked about making record for radio play, and you realized that's not the truth of your path. What is the truth of your path? Are you able to define that? Have you been able to articulate that?
I think the truth of my path would be what I believe should be the path of all artists, which is not allowing any external forces to come in during the process of making the art and diluting it in any way, or tampering with it in any way. So for example, I mean, an example that artists, the people that make music have to bow down to, whoever they are, whether it's me or whether it's, you know, Wu-Tang Clan or whether it's Radiohead or whoever it might be, is explicit words being bleeped on the radio. I've got a track out at the moment called People Say, and it's been played on the radio quite a lot. And there's a line in it which goes, "And when I look you in the eye, it's time for fighting." I never really thought too much about that, but somebody like the BBC might go, "Well, you know, there's a war on at the moment, fighting. We don't want to remind people that there's a war on."
Yeah.
You know, despite the fact that they might see it on the BBC News and hear about it on the BBC News. I remember when during the first Gulf War, or during the first illegal invasion of Iraq, massive attack were forced by radio to change their name to Massive.
I didn't know that.
Which they were, so the DJ would go, "And here's Massive with Unfinished Sympathy."
You got Massive what? And then
just Massive Compromise. you know, but I guess but you know, I mean, I just, you know, that's no indictment on them whatsoever, you know. But you know, so you have to sort of, I guess, pick your battles, and you have to realize what's important and what's not important. And so I don't think that's answered your question, though. Could you repeat your question again, please?
I think that really does answer my question, because, you know, talking about not compromising, and what it makes me think of is times in my life as a writer, as a journalist, where I've, you know, you get stuck in what's expected of you rather than, you know, the pure source or that kind of thing that I think it's almost like a waste of time to try and define that pure source because you are it. You know, you can't really define your personality. We're all different. We all have our unique parts that I think it's sort of more fun, really, to not try and define it. I mean, you know, you said something really interesting earlier, which is you said from the time that you dared call yourself an artist. Do you remember that, what that time was? And have you had different stages of your life that you've thought, no, I don't want to define myself as that? Or, and then, you know, at times that changes and you're like, okay, well, I am, because that's what I'm here for. You know, that's where I find joy in life. What's your story of acknowledging that you're an artist?
Well, the last real job that I had was, I was a car mechanic. And so up to the point where I stopped doing that, I'd been hanging around for the previous year with some artists from the Edinburgh Art College, John McLean and Robin Jones and Sean McCloskey and Gordon Anderson. And so in my social life, I sort of was just surrounded by that kind of weird version of masculinity, which I guess people these days call this toxic masculinity, which is, you know, talking about women in a certain way, being homophobic, being racist, you know, having this really sort of puffed up hard man persona, and drinking, spitting, you know, that kind of ludicrous version of maleness. And I wasn't like that, but people I knew I saw it everywhere, you know, but it just seemed like, even at the time when it was kind of like the norm, it seemed ludicrous and really pathetic, just a cul-de-sac of development as a human being. So when I started hanging around with real artists, with painters and poets and sculptors and musicians, I sort of had this epiphany that I realized that because those people that I sort of knew in my social life and stuff, you know, they would completely pour scorn on anyone if you talked about your feelings or anything like that, let alone write a song. I mean, they all listen to music. And I was just thinking, where the fuck do you think this music comes from? Do you think it comes from some fucking He-Man racist down the pub who's, I mean, you'll sit around listening to the Specials. You think the Specials, you know, do you think Terry Hall doesn't talk and think about his feelings?
Yeah.
You know, and so I realized that the artists were the brave ones. They were the ones to be admired. They were the ones who were putting everything on the line and talking fearlessly about their feelings and about how they saw the world and in a way that was so brutally honest that it was very disarming. And I think that ever since I sort of realized that, I started doing that myself. And I've always used that as a way to disarm people, I suppose, is to just be incredibly honest. And so I show people very early on that I'm very unafraid to talk about how I feel about them, how I feel about me, how I feel about the situation, how I feel about what they're saying. Because I think I just want people to know very quickly that I'm just not interested in bullshit. I just want to have an open and honest conversation. And if you don't want to have that with me, that's fine. But you are going to have to walk away from me.
That's good. So you were a car mechanic. What age was that?
I think I was a car mechanic from about 16 to about sort of 20, 21, maybe something like that, I think.
Now, that's a good skill to have, especially if you're about to start going on tour.
Well, it was. But the problem is that when I was a car mechanic, it was still very much pre-electronics. So it was about, you know, setting points and, you know, the old school way of servicing a car. But just as I was quitting, you know, engine management systems were coming in and everything was becoming much more electronically controlled. So I could certainly do a few shifts at a classic car garage, but not really at a modern day garage. So I quit being a car mechanic in 92 or 93. Moved to London in 94, and then we got signed in 96 or 97.
That, you know, that change of life from coming down to London, you know, what was that move for you? Do you remember, you know, your emotions then? Do you remember how you were feeling about that? Your first impressions, maybe?
I was dating a girl at the time from Glasgow, and she'd got on a she'd become a student nurse. She was going to Dulwich College, so she was going down. She'd moved there, so I was going down sort of once a month. By kind of 1993, I was going down there once a month, pretty much anyway. So I kind of knew what to expect, but it just. When you're that age, it's such a great time to go to London because you can put up with anything. You know, if you're living somewhere shit, then it doesn't matter because you don't care because you're in London and you want to be in London. And also it was great back then because you had a fully functioning social security system. So you could get the dole and you could get housing benefit. So right. if you managed to get sort of £200 or £300 for the deposit, you could have a flat and you could have your flat paid for. You could just spend all your time writing and learning how to write songs and trying to start a band and all that kind of stuff. So it was a really different world back then compared to what it is now. I think London was everything I expected it to be. I went there to meet people from different cultures and to be exposed directly to some of the music that I loved and to just fully immerse myself in I guess, more modern youth culture, what was actually happening at the time. So it was great. It was a great place to be, and I don't ever regret making that move. You know, I would have been. I still know people now that have been stuck their entire lives in the places where I was from, and that's great. That's great for them if they like it. But I think even just from a personal development point of view, you know, it's good to have. You know, I mean, I the first place that I lived at in London was this old Jamaican couple in Brixton, and they had a house, and they were basically renting out the top half of the house to me and my girlfriend, and they lived in the bottom house. And even just that, just sharing a sort of a space with them, you just learn so much about you know, a culture that you don't really know anything about. I mean, I knew the music, but you know, you don't know. And it was great. And being in Brixton at that time as well was great. You know, mostly it was still a little bit dangerous.
Yeah.
But again, when you're young, you don't really care about that either. It's exciting. So
which music halls, which music venues or bands do you remember from that time?
To be honest, I've never really been a big gig person. I've been to a lot of clubs. But I haven't really been to see that many bands. I was always much more kind of club person. But we used to go to a place called the Mars Bar, which was opposite where the Astoria was. So if you on the corner of the Astoria, there was a little street, tiny little street that runs down towards Soho Square, and right. At the top of that street, kind of opposite the where the Astoria used to be, there was a little club there down, and you went downstairs there. And we used to go there. We used to go Talvin Singh. He started up a club there as well. We used to go to that Rails near Euston. Brilliant nights. There was a night there called the Frat Shack. And that was probably the best club I've ever been to in my life. It was just a crazy mix of people. There was sort of a lot of the mods used to go there. And then a lot of the kind of rockabillies used to go as well. And every sort of subculture around that, because they played a sort of within a sort of fairly tight framework. They played a huge amount of music within that framework, which brought in kind of a very strange a mix you just wouldn't find anywhere else. Like you'd never, yeah. back then, you'd never get mods going to a rockabilly club and vice versa. Or, you know, and there was that whole kind of medway scene thing, which had spilled into London as well. And you had Liam Watson, who at that time had a studio in Old Street. And so you had that whole toe rag kind of scene going on, and that was part of it. And that was an amazing club, though.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
You've talked about how after Heroes to Zeros that you had a depressive time because you owed a lot of money to the label, and that must have been a very confusing time. You'd had this pretty amazingly effective career to so many people, and that still carries on today. I mean, I suppose my question is, you know, when did you come through that fug? When did you come through that the other side of that dense period where it was, you know, not so much of an enjoyable part of your life?
Well, I mean, the depression I had lasted from about probably 1993 to about 2010.
Right.
So yeah, I had throughout the whole of the Beta Band, I was really, really struggling with my mental health and with depression and stuff. So yeah, the whole, I mean, I around the time of Heroes to Hot Shots 2, I went on antidepressants, which leveled me up quite a bit, but still there was still issues, but they definitely helped for a period. But if you're asking me when I sort of managed to get out of the depression thing, I guess it was probably about 7 or 8 years ago, really actually properly managed to put it to bed and, you know, and deal with everything that was sort of the causes of that, and put those things to bed. But it was partially because I did a lot of work on it, and partially I think age really helped me, just getting older and my mind slowing down and not being quite so dramatic and teenage about everything, you know.
I find that really interesting that you were writing all through that time, because you know, I've had troubles with similar types of stuff, and I found it really hard to write with it. Other times I found it hard to write without it. You know, it's like kind of fuck. So yeah, it's great that you were writing the whole time. That's amazing. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. We've got 4 minutes left. Sorry, it doesn't feel very nice rushing, but thank you so much for your time, Steve. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure.
I like to end these interviews with, you know, I think there's a massive culture of thinking you're the best. You're talking about the masculinity thing, like, you know, you never fuck up at work, you never make mistakes, you're always the best at what you do. And like, people try and hide their mistakes, especially in the workplace. I wondered if you've got any gaps or any kind of errors that you've made in the workplace. I suppose at this point in your life, there could be ones to do with playing music, but does anything come to mind?
To be honest, I've learned far more from my mistakes than I ever have any victories I've ever had. I think people completely underestimate making mistakes and making wrong decisions and getting in the shit as a way to move forward. The idea that everything is perfect all the time and everything's great, well, that's just some marketing man's fucking wet dream. Life is not like that. So you have to embrace these things. You have to embrace the mistakes, embrace the stupid things you do, embrace the fact that you might have said something which hurts someone. It gives you a chance to apologize to them and be a bigger person. And you learn, you learn far more from your mistakes than you will ever learn from any victories you ever have.
That's a great message. Thanks so much, Steve.
Take it easy. Nice to meet you.
You too. Bye-bye.
See ya. Bye.
So that was Steve Mason here on 101 Part-Time Jobs.
His new album, Brothers and Sisters, is out this Friday. You can catch him on tour this spring. See you later this week with a new episode with Jen Clower from Australia. See you then. Here's Cox Barra. I've been working all day, bobbing my head on the side, running around like a blue-ass fly. I've been working, yeah, I've been working all day, bobbing my head. Every blink of me, I've been on the go, up and down the ladder like a fiddler's little bow. I've been working, yeah, I've been working all day, bobbing my head. This is a Mighty Moon Media podcast.
The headlines remind us daily, the world is a dangerous place. The elites in charge say everything's fine, stop noticing. But you know better. And your gut knows that time is short to prepare for a world that is four missed meals away from chaos. My Patriot Supply has helped over 3 million families become more self-reliant and is the company Americans trust to prepare. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com and secure their best-selling 3-month emergency food kits. Each contain delicious breakfasts, lunches, and dinners, averaging over 2,000 calories per day. Secure at least one food kit for each family member. For a limited time, save $200, plus get free shipping on all their Ready Hour 3-month emergency food kits. You're not ready if it's not Ready Hour foods. My Patriot Supply also has solar power generators, water filtration units, biomass stoves, heirloom seeds, and critical survival gear. Shop MyPatriotSupply.com today. MyPatriotSupply.com.